Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips. For those just joining us, we just heard from Sanjeev Gupta, Managing Partner, Emerging Markets, Mergers and Acquisitions, EMEA Transaction Services for Ernst & Young. He was giving us his insights to running a business successfully in the African, South Asian markets and some interesting insights into the bottom of the pyramid. You know, 70% of the population of Africa, apparently from his research, is under 18 years old, and continually FMCG companies and other companies are vying for a foothold in this market, which could be one of the most exciting ones that we've seen in a couple centuries as it starts to blossom and finds its feet, if it does. But maybe someone who can even help add a bit more light to the question, who's one of the most prolific economists in the Middle East, North African region, who is Dr. Nasser Essaidi, the founder and managing director of Nasser Essaidi and Associates and the former chief economist of the DIFC. Let's hear a little bit more about his background before we start here. So this is the bio of Dr. Nasser Essaidi.
Dr. Nasser Essaidi is the founder and managing director of Nasser Essaidi and Associates, a specialized niche advisory and consulting company that was set up in 2012 following a stint at the DIFC as the chief economist and head of external relations between 2006 and 2012. As an ardent corporate governance advocate, he also established and managed the Hawkama Institute for Corporate Governance and the Mudara Institute of Directors in the DIFC. Dr. Essaidi is also a member of the IMS Regional Advisory Group for MENA and co-chair of the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development's MENA Corporate Governance Working Group. He chairs the Regional Clean Energy Business Council. In 2012, he was named among the 50 most influential Arabs in the world by the Middle East magazine for the fourth consecutive year. Dr. Essaidi was the Minister of Economy and Trade and Minister of Industry of Lebanon between 1998 and 2000. He was the first Vice Governor of the Central Bank of Lebanon for two consecutive mandates, 1993 to 98 and 1998 to 2003. Prior to his public career, Dr. Nasser pursued a career as an academic, serving as a professor of economics at the University of Chicago, the Institut Universitaire des Hautes Études Internationales in Geneva, Switzerland, and the Université de Genève. Dr. Nasser Essaidi holds a PhD and an MA in economics from the University of Rochester in the US, and Master of Science from the University College London University, and a Bachelor of Arts from the American University of Beirut.
Wow, that's quite a background, Doctor. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And, you know, I've always enjoyed your presentations, which I went to numerous of them when you were the chief economist at the DIFC, and I always had an interesting take on some of the key issues in the region. So it was, we're pretty excited to have you on the show tonight.
Great to be with you.
But, you know, what's your advice to someone, you know, as you developed your career and you kind of look back on it, you know, what were some of the kind of key milestone moments that really helped you lay the bedrock of being a chief economist? You know, because it's quite a profile to have at the point where you're advising, you know, even royalty on, you know, what's happening with the economy. You know, for someone who wanted to follow in your footsteps, what are some of kind of the key stepping stones that, you know, you think you really helps you get, you know, spread your wings and fly?
I think the first thing, just to come back, when we first started the program, you were talking about Africa. And I think my starting point was actually Africa. I was visiting my father. He's Lebanese. He migrated to Nigeria, spent a good 50 years of his life working there. I used to visit him during the summers, and what struck me, and this was really my first introduction to extreme poverty, it was poverty that led me into economics. Why was it there were so many disparities? What was the inequality? How could you explain that? Not only between countries, we know that, but between people within countries. That's what really led me to economics. I'd been studying and training in philosophy until then. I shifted during high school and then continued a career as an economist all along. The guiding issue all my life was how do you explain poverty? What do you do about it? And that, I think, we're living it today. If you look at the recent numbers, Oxfam just published just 2 days ago a study reporting that the 1% of the richest people in the world own at least 50% of the wealth of the world. That is a striking number.
Unbelievable.
It is.
And
it's a challenge, and it's a challenge, and I think it's one of the main issues, I think, that people need to think about in their own lives. How do they deal with poverty that is really present all the way around us?
So in a sense, you know, really your guiding light or, you know, kind of the North Star through your career was kind of this humanitarian thread that, you know, you want to make a difference, you want to create an impact or at somehow, you know, at least shed some light into the darkness of this poverty equation.
I think absolutely. I think it's wanting to make a difference in life in whatever you do. And it's not just as an economist, it's in anything that you do. And I think if there's any lesson in life is that you have to have a guiding force within you, something which is a vision, which takes you forward in whatever you do in life. And you have to be passionate about it, I think. Anything that you do, be passionate about it.
And so you were fortunate in the sense that even back in high school, you found a sense of purpose that, you know, hey, this is what I'm going to at least look at making a contribution to.
Yes. And and if you look at today's world, what's striking is that we are having just living through the great financial crisis, as we now call it. There's at least one whole generation in Europe and also in our part of the world that is missing that sense of purpose. We are living very high unemployment rates in our region. Unemployment rate of youth is upwards of 30%. In some countries it's over 40%, particularly for women. Very
for
high
youth, though, but
rate.
Aren't you supposed to be unemployed when you're youth? Isn't that like part of it?
No.
I mean, a lot of these people don't want jobs, right? Don't they? I think.
Oh, I'm struck by the fact that say if I look at my own children, they love to work in summertime. They took short-term jobs in the summertime, and that transformed their life because when later on in life they finished university, wanted to go into the job market, they already had a feeling for what it means to get a job and to maintain it. How do you present yourself? What is it that gives you a purpose in life? And that's extremely important. And when you look at youth sitting in the streets, smoking shisha, drinking tea or coffee without much purpose, that's what leads to many social, political, and economic problems. And we're living that right now.
Hmm. We like to say that they're investing in their interpersonal skill sets. They're doing that, but I think you're right that you know there's maybe not that push to work. And you know, I think I got my first job at 13 years old, mm-hmm. Selling ice cream.
But yes.
And then actually before that the paper route, but the paper route doesn't count. That was just something everybody did, I guess. But is it when you look at the statistic that 1% owns over 50% of the wealth? Is that you know really a byproduct of, you know, some kind of larger theme, or is it simply that, you know, those individuals who are focused on creating wealth are the ones who are, you know, able to do it? Is it actually becoming easier to acquire wealth? I mean, there's a lot of information saying that it's easier now to acquire wealth than ever before.
Well, certainly acquiring it in the financial markets has been much easier than before. But I think there are two forces at work which we cannot neglect. One is technology. And if you look at the immense fortunes that have been created over the past 15, 20 years, many of them are related to new technologies, to information and communications technologies, and to networking. I think the big change is networking. How do you reach people? You were mentioning social media a minute ago. And accessibility of technology to reach a very large number of people at a very, very low cost, which can generate immense fortunes. That's one part. The other part, which is also very, very clear, is that the skilled segment of the population is earning much more than the unskilled. And new technologies which are coming in tend to depress the wages and salaries and earnings of the lower skilled. So what we're having is a combination of technological forces, but also education and skill differences among people, leading to enormous gaps. In addition, of course, you've got very ambitious people. So we're talking about the 1% who are also ambitious, who want to get there. However, there's also one other element which we cannot neglect, and Thomas Piketty's Capital, which an excellent book which I recommend, pointed to the fact that more and more wealth is also inherited. So along with the technological forces, along with education and acquired skills, there's also a great deal of inherited wealth. And therein lies the danger. If you have more and more inherited wealth, then it's more difficult to undo that.
But at the same time, we now, you know, you heard of that Stanford professor who put his course online, and then the girl who, you know, the person out of 20,000 people took the test, the yes. person with the highest mark wasn't one of his students, it was a 12-year-old girl from Pakistan.
That's true.
And so now you have these equalizers where, you know, I can be in a village in Pakistan or a village in Rwanda, and I can access a Stanford University professor's lectures at the click
that,
of a button.
That, I think, is extremely helpful for the future. That's true. But one needs to realize that we're talking about people at the margin. It'll take a long time to bring many people out of poverty, allow access to education, allow access to finance, deal with gender inequality, deal with many inequalities that we have across societies. So individual action is important, but you also need social action. You need political action. It's one thing to note the statistics and note the numbers, but you need to do something about it. You as an individual in life can improve perhaps your lot, and great, we should give more tools, online learning, access, great, but I think you also need political and social action.
So, you know, it seems like we're getting a lot of mixed data, though, on this topic. Like, on one hand, they're saying that I think it's 2/3 of those individuals in India who are in the middle class became middle class in the last decade or last 15 years. I don't know if that's correct, but it's a huge number that every year are transferring from poverty into the middle classes.
It's actually China. India hasn't done much to improve poverty, and poverty levels have been fairly stagnant and fairly high in India. If you look at the statistics, the global statistics, world poverty over the past 25 years has declined. The main reason is China. China pulled something like 350 million people wow. out of poverty over the space of a generation to 1.5 generations. I think that is the big story. That's not yet happened in India. And that is the reason why you're seeing a China being able to grow so fast. And growth and pulling people out of poverty tend to go together.
This is Dr. Nasser Saidi, founder and managing director of Nasser Saidi and Associates, the former chief economist of the DIFC. He'll be giving us more of his insights on the global markets and poverty, I guess, as well in just a minute.
Dubai Eye 103.8. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are here with Dr. Nasser Saidi. Dr. Nasser, welcome back.
Thank you.
For those of you just joining us, Dr. Nasser was just giving us, shedding some light into the global poverty issues. And I guess Oxfam had released a study that said 1% of the world's most wealthy own 50% of the world's resources, and is an alarming statistic. And starts to highlight the disparity between the less fortunate and the most fortunate, and almost paints a picture that poverty is getting worse. But overall, the trend has moved, and Dr. Nasser was pointing out that's just really because of China. So if you actually take China out of the poverty equation and look at the numbers, is poverty in the world actually getting worse?
There's been some gradual improvement. So if you look at the statistics as measured by the World Bank, they usually measure it by the number of people, the proportion of people living on $1 or less or $2 or less per day. And that's a shocking number. Can you imagine yourself living on a dollar a day? In the Emirates, we're talking about 3.67 dirham per day, or double that, at around 7 dirham per day. It's an incredible number. So we measure the proportion of people who live on less than $2. And on a global basis, you've still got 40% of the world living on less than $2 per day. That is a shocking number. So although that has declined, we're talking about marginal changes. We still haven't really addressed the issue of poverty in many countries in the world. And it's around us. It's in the even in the Arab world. It's very much into Africa, but you also have that in the States, Latin America, and much of Asia. So it's pervasive. It's around us. And I think it's the single most important thing that we should be working on.
And do you think we're going to see any big shifts as we move into the 21st century, that this issue will get worse? I think Bill Gates said by 2030, poverty will be eradicated.
That's an aspiration. Right. Jeff Sachs, Bill Gates, and others have that aspiration. We've put that as part of the Millennium 2015 goals. We're certainly not there. I doubt very much that we'd reach that. The other point, of course, is that poverty is relative, right? So you need to look at social indicators as well. What we need to address is that on a daily basis, people should not die because of malnutrition, because of ill health, because of factors which are purely physical. So we should be able to give them a life where they can sustain themselves. But beyond that, you need to think of, how do you get fulfillment? What is the meaning of happiness in life? So it's not just the material indicators. It's interesting if you look at statistics and you ask people who are happy, you'll find that they're not necessarily in the richest of countries or in the more materially well off. Some of the people who are happiest in the world live in relatively simple environments. So it's not a matter only of material wealth. But if you look forward, the main issue I think we're going to be facing is one of technology. In particular, we're entering into an age of increasing use of robotics. And I think the danger there is that robotics will tend to displace a lot of low-skilled workers. Think back just 20 years or 25 years when you had pools of typewriter assistants and secretaries working on typewriters. That world has ended. Think of all the jobs that ended as a result of that. So we're digitizing many occupations, many jobs. The big challenge is, as we displace those low-skilled people, what's going to happen to them? How do we retrain them? And I think one of the most important things that we need to look at is the role of education. We tend to think of education as something that happens when we're young. We go through childhood, we go to high school, then we go to university, and we think, that's it, I got my degree, I get on in life. That is the past. We can no longer think that way for two reasons. Number one, people are living much longer. Health standards, nutrition standards have been improving. That means that the expected lifetime of a child, at least in developed countries, a child born today in developed countries can expect to live to the age of 100. Other things constant, okay? So we're tending to live much longer. You need to ask yourself, would the knowledge that I acquire in the first 15 or 20 years of my life be enough to sustain me in a working environment for the remaining 8 years? And the answer is no. So we need to rethink education. It's got to be a continuing process. But the big challenge, I think, over the next 10, 15 years, particularly as more and more emerging markets emerge, as Asia and Africa, Latin America, produce more of people, how will they emerge themselves? Will they get the education allowing them to compete with a more technological-oriented world, with a more robotic world?
Right. So, you know, I was looking at this also in the U.S., for example, where, you know, they do have job growth, but it's in the high skill area. It's in the digital skill area. It's in, you know, and the lower end skills where they actually need the job. That's actually growing. So the jobs are disappearing where they need them, and they're appearing. And in fact, they're importing talent to fill a lot of these high-tech jobs.
And when you look at the numbers, in particular in the United States, where we have excellent statistics, if you look at wage inequality, it's actually risen. It's actually risen over the past two decades. That's what people are complaining about. So the discrepancy between, say, the compensation of a CEO and the average worker in a company can be up to 100, 200, 300 or more. It's those discrepancies that we're talking about. And the issue is, can we use technology more intelligently? Can we educate people so that they become self-educating, so that they can go online, as you were mentioning a bit earlier, and be able to benefit from a professor who's teaching at MIT or Stanford or somewhere else? You still need basic education. So what happens in the first 5 years of your life contributes something like 35 to 40% of your lifetime chances. That's what science is teaching us. Those first 5 years can make all the difference to the rest of your life.
In terms of where you sit economically?
Where you sit economically.
40% of where you sit economically depends on your first 5 years.
And socially, yes.
Wow.
Your ability to learn, your ability to understand your environment, much of that gets determined in the first 5 years of life. So although you can say, well, I've got access to a computer and to the internet and I make that cheap, that does not undo the effects of those first 5 years.
So so that's research then suggests we're prisoners of our own mind.
No, it just says that we need to give much more attention to the early years of life. It also means that we need to give much more attention to the health of the mother and to make sure that mothers in the earlier age, that nurturing in those early ages in the first 5 years gets much more attention than we currently give it. We tend to not think much of it. We think it happens automatically. Part of it does, but you can make all the difference by making sure that children at young ages don't suffer from malnutrition, live in a healthy environment, and that their mothers are healthy.
So the trends you're painting here are fairly chronic. You know, the picture that we're looking at in the United States, you know, as we see this wage disparity grow, you know, we look at the current trends that it's not slowing down, it's accelerating. So what we should expect then is actually more social unrest in areas which virtually didn't have it in the past. Is that what we're looking at?
If you listen carefully to the State of the Union address of President Obama, just yesterday, he raised the issue of inequality, and he's right to raise it. It's become a major issue in the United States, even though the United States is famous, of course, for being a society which says it's an opportunity for all, it's the equal opportunity. It turns out that is not true, that American dream is no longer an American dream for the majority of society. So
They say you have to be asleep to believe it.
That's true. and so I think it's raising the issue is, again, what sort of political action, what sort of social action, economic action you need to take to undo some of those trends and to hold them back.
But at the same time, you have example after example of individuals coming complete rags to riches stories. And in fact, the epic movie Pursuit of Happiness is there. So
it's not to deny that. I'm not denying that. I'm not trying to be the eternal pessimist economist, which economists typically are. But I'm pointing to trends and technology and social forces that are at work and that we need to be aware of. I'm eternally optimistic on the other side, you see. I tend to believe in the forces of education above all. And if there's one thing that we need to focus on, it is on education, of allowing people access to education. And the point is it needs to start very early on if we need to make sure that people have good opportunities later on in life.
So beyond getting, you know, being in the right geography and having the right mindset and getting, you know, the first 5 years, sometimes we can't control that. When you look back at your career, what are some kind of the real defining moments that really led to your success that you think?
Oh, I think I didn't have much respect for authority. I think that was part of it. When I was at school, at university, I felt, well, yes, they were teaching me simply because they were older, so they had the knowledge. I think questioning authority is extremely important in life, and you should always question that. And I've done that. So I think that's been a formative force in what I've done. The other, I think, is seeking diversity, wanting to do different things. So I've been an academic, I've been a professor, I shifted into being a consultant, then became a banker, because a lot of my consulting was for central banks and for banks, so I eventually became a banker, then became central banker, because I got the enormous opportunity in life to go back and help rebuild my country that had been destroyed through civil war. I used to go and come, but this was an occasion to help rebuild. So it was great to be able to be able to go back. Went back, spent a good 12 years of my life in central banking and as a minister. And that certainly was a defining moment, if I wanted to use a term. You rarely get a chance in life to make a difference. And I think if I have a word of advice, always try to think of how you can make a difference. It can be a small difference. It can be saying something nice to a person. Or it can be getting involved in social action, in political action, in economic action, and trying to make a difference in life. So I think, again, advice, go for diversity. Don't get stuck in one occupation or one activity. It tends to be deadly. It kills your mind, it kills your imagination. Try to get as diverse a set of experiences as you can. Try to do as much of it early on in life. So travel, go, experience different things. Don't be afraid of taking risks. Things will always turn out. So go for diversity.
This is Dr. Nasser Saidi, founder and managing director of Nasser Saidi and Associates. He's going to be giving us some insight into what's happening with the oil price in just a minute. So stay with us. This is one analysis you're definitely going to want to hear.
Dubai Eye 103.8, keeping you up to date with what matters in the UAE. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips. We are here with Dr. Nasser Saidi. He's really giving us some great insights into global economics, the poverty equation, some of the predictions for what will happen with the U.S. market. He's the founder and managing director of Nasser Saidi and Associates. He's also the former chief economist of the DIFC, and he has a bio that is quite impressive and long. And I would suggest, if you missed any of this, you may want to go to our website and go to dubaii1038.com/ionCareers and go to our podcast section maybe pick up the podcast and look at it. And before that, we also had Sanjeev Gupta, who is the managing partner, mergers and acquisitions, EMEA transaction services for Ernst & Young, talking about, you know, his predictions for the African market and what it takes to be successful, both strategically, tactically, and from a capability standpoint in the Middle East, African, South Asian markets. So these were some pretty insightful interviews. Dr. Nasser, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thank you.
This is the the moment that we've been waiting for, at least, you know, I have, to know what's going on with our oil price. What's the prediction over the next little while? What can we expect?
Well, I think the first thing to note is that this is not the first time we've had a collapse in the oil price. We've seen it in the past decade, back in 2008, 2009, where you had a sharp drop from about $140 down to $42 per barrel. So this is not the first big oil shock that we've had in the past decade. You need to, however, to understand, if you want to look forward, you need to understand what are the forces at work. And there are several forces, but the dominant force is low economic growth at a global level, and in particular in China and emerging markets. It is the China factor which has made all the difference to oil price over the past decade. China was growing at double-digit growth rates. It's energy poor and importing a great deal of oil and many commodities. So what happened is, and it was not just oil, we had a commodity price boom because of China and other emerging markets growing very fast. On the other side, if you look at Europe, United States, energy efficiency was growing. So to produce one unit of output, one unit of GDP, they were using less and less energy. So big contrast, emerging markets led by China, using more and more oil, raising the demand for oil, but at the same time, lower demand for oil coming from US and Europe. What does that mean in particular for the Middle East? It meant that over the short space of one decade, China became the number one importer of Saudi oil, and already 3 years ago replaced the United States as the main importer of Saudi oil. So if you look at the big geostrategic changes, that's a big geostrategic change. So less reliance by the United States and Europe on Middle Eastern oil. But now we've had a slowdown in economic growth in China, in emerging markets, and globally. So that's lowered the demand for oil. That's one aspect. The other aspect, of course, is growing oil supplies. And it's not just OPEC, which has decided to maintain production even though growth and demand was declining. They decided to maintain production. That was a momentous decision. So it meant that you had oversupply in the market. But add to that is non-OPEC oil supply, in particular shale oil and gas from the United States and also other countries such as Canada. So all that led to increasing supply, oversupply in the market. And you projected that forward. Markets were looking at oil prices over $100 per barrel. That encouraged non-traditional oil, what we call tight oil, shale and related. So you project that forward with low economic growth, you get lower oil prices. So moving forward, what can we expect? Part of it depends on decisions by OPEC. Will they maintain current levels? There is dissension within OPEC. 2 days ago, if you heard the oil minister and finance ministers from Oman is complaining about the fact that the OPEC production decision is hurting them, and they're being hurt. And all the countries of the GCC are being hurt. So there's now dissension within OPEC itself as to strategy. So that's one element. Will they change strategy? Will they lower production? Will you get higher economic growth? Looks unlikely during 2015. IMF's just issued its World Economic Outlook, a revision to its World Economic Outlook. It's shaved down world economic growth. So what was the hope? The hope was that maybe if you lowered prices, then it would drive out shale oil producers. And true enough, many shale oil producers cannot survive at an oil price below $60 or $65. So it might drive them out. The problem is that shale does not require a big investment. So you can turn off, you can drill a well, it'll cost you $2 to $3 million in most locations. You can turn it off, it's not a big expenditure, you just turn it off. When the prices rise again, you can start drilling again and getting the oil out. So you're probably going to look at maybe 2 to 3 years of relatively low oil prices. Now, what are the implications for us in the region? One implication, of course, is that oil revenues for governments have declined by about 50%. They will need to adjust to that. they have the financial buffers, they have the fiscal buffers, we've got the international reserves. So it's not a full-fledged crisis. But eventually, over time, you will have to adjust if prices remain low. You don't want to continue with low government revenues arising from oil. That means several things. You'll want to look to diversify your government revenues, look to alternative sources of revenues. I've been on the record to say, and that has not made me the most popular of economists, but I've been on the record to say, well, this is the time to remove subsidies. We need to remove subsidies which we currently give to fossil fuels, to diesel and gasoline. That distorts consumption and production choices. We should even impose taxes, excise taxes, on the use of gasoline, on the use of tobacco, and other items. So this is a time at which you want a big shift. You want a fiscal reform in order to adjust to this. And you want to start off by removing subsidies. At the same time, I think you want to look at greater energy efficiency in our region. I chair the Clean Energy Business Council. And when we look across the region, there are two elements which are extremely important, which we are enormous consumers of energy. We use twice as much energy as the average industrial country to produce one unit of output, one unit of GDP.
That's in the GCC or?
In the GCC.
Okay.
In fact,
we use double? Is that what you just said?
Double. So you take a country like Saudi Arabia, it uses more oil than Germany, right? With about less than one-third of the population and one-tenth of the output. Those are shocking numbers. So you need to do something about that. It means you need to think about energy efficiency. Now, positive news, good news. UAE is at the forefront, is trying to do a lot to improve energy efficiency.
Is this just looking at the industries? Like, because I know in Saudi, one of the favorite things to do is just drive around. Because there's not, that's not much else. Got, like, that's like a pastime in Saudi is like, let's go
housing,
for a drive.
Housing, absolutely. Housing, transportation. But a lot of industries which are very, very energy intensive, you take some of them like cement, aluminum, and all the rest, they use a lot of energy to produce output. So you need to rethink your strategy. You want to diversify economic activity, that's true, but you want to do it by being energy efficient. So energy efficiency means using less in terms of buildings. You don't need to freeze if you're entering into a mall. It's perfectly okay to live at 22 or 23 degrees. You don't need to be at 16 to 18. You don't.
Well, the cinemas are freezing.
Absolutely. You don't need to drive a one-ton four-wheel drive at 120 kilometers down the highway. So things like that can be dealt with. So energy efficiency is a major one. But you also need to give incentives for people to become energy efficient, and that means higher prices.
Right. So, but what's really going to happen to the overall economy here? As you know, your prediction just called for 3 years of low oil prices. So, you know, what does that do to the average business? You know, will our, you know, we have the number one shopping destination in the world. Is our retail sector going to be hit? You know, we're globally competitive in the hospitality space. Will that be affected?
I think Dubai and the UAE will be less adversely affected than other countries. Take a country like Saudi, or a Bahrain. The reason is that you have a more diversified economy. So today, 70% of your economy is non-oil. So that's trade, tourism, other services, manufacturing, and the rest. So we will not be as severely affected as others. True, you have a slowdown. It might affect us. It'll depend also on what policies will be pursued by other GCC countries. Will Saudi, for example, reduce government spending? Likely is they will continue in 2015 to continue at a relatively high rate of spending, but they're likely to postpone projects which they've been looking at, postpone them into later years. So 2016 and beyond might be more problematic if the oil price remains low. So 2015 is an adjustment period. Look out then whether or not the oil price is going to be persistently low. There will have to be more important adjustments in 2016 moving forward.
So you pick for those business people in Dubai, you feel we will weather the storm okay?
We'll certainly weather it better than others because of the openness of the economy, because we've got trade and tourism. We're not reliant on the oil. And at the same time, I think you've got more links to countries like India, which is picking up well under Modi, and to emerging markets such as Africa. So I think we're less exposed than we were in the past to Europe and the United States, which I think is a good thing. I've been always a strong advocate of shifting our policies towards Africa, towards emerging markets, towards China and Asia. That has been a savior.
Right. This is Dr. Nasser Saidi, the founder and managing director of Nasser Saidi and Associates, a former chief economist of the DIFC, sharing his views of the region with us. He'll be right back in just a minute.
Dubai Eye 103.8, award-winning news, business, sport, and lifestyle coverage. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are here with Dr. Nasser Saidi. Dr. Nasser, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Pleasure to be back with you.
For those just joining us, Dr. Nasser is the former chief economist of the DIFC and is the managing director of Nasser Saidi and Associates, a specialized niche advisory and consulting company that he runs here and services clients, I imagine, across the Middle East, North African region.
Absolutely.
So, when one of the things you were just talking about is a slight speed bump in the economy as a result of this oil price situation. And the other thing you mentioned was that we probably haven't really felt the effect yet due to the fiscal buffers that are in place.
Well, government spending is continuing. So I think that'll mean that you'll have some slower growth. 2005, I think, will still be good. Maybe 2016 and onwards will be more problematic. Dubai, I think, and the UAE is well served precisely because you're less dependent. You're talking about trade, tourism, new activities emerging. Construction continues strong. You've got Dubai Expo 2020. You've got new projects on the ground. You've got Al Maktoum Airport. So those are transformational, what I call transformational events for Dubai. And I think that'll help carry you through. The other, I think, important factor is the links, as we were talking a bit earlier, to countries like Africa, to countries like India, Central Asia, and the rest. Of course, a lot will depend on whether or not China's growth will continue slowing and at what rate it will be slowing. I'm struck, for example, by the fact that if you look at tourists into Dubai, more and more tourists come from Asia, more and more tourists come from China. You look at the number of Chinese companies, banks, financial institutions that are here that have chosen Dubai and the UAE as their hub. Those have been accelerating, and I think that trend will continue, merely because of the sheer size of foreign investment by countries like by a country like China. You're talking about massive capital outflow, and that will continue. I don't think that will tend to slow down, because in particular China is benefiting from the lower oil price. China's a net oil importer, so China will be better off through the lower oil price. So I think that will help Chinese growth, and that will mean more Chinese tourism, more Chinese trade.
But I think the other thing that's also helping us, isn't it, that a lot of the multinationals that are you know, headquartered in Europe or in the U.S. have flat or even negative growth in their home market. So they're forced to look at these markets to find their next growth spurt.
And they have. And I think the success story, I think, in this part of the Gulf is that it has become a regional hub. And it's a regional hub for trade, for business, for conferences and the like. And it has all the advantages. I think the free zones have been a game changer. If you look at the amount of investment going into the free zones, it's not only capital, it's also people. We were talking about this a bit earlier. What's attractive about the UAE and Dubai is that it is a good place to live. So if you ask people what would be their choice location would be the UAE because of low levels of taxation or nearly no taxation, good working environment, excellent infrastructure, excellent connectivity, and at the same time, you're between Africa and Asia. So those locational factors play a very, very important role. So when you're thinking of relocating, where else would you locate to if you're out of a job in Europe? This is one of the better places to be.
But I think also, His Highness Sheikh Mohammed has done a great job in creating the safety factor, the rule of law.
It is. It is a safe haven. Dubai is a safe haven and recognized by everybody. So it's the rule of law, but it's also stability at a time at which the rest of the region looks very uncertain and very unstable. And that means people and companies relocate towards this part of the world, and Dubai in particular.
Yeah, I think it's one of the only countries in the world where you could, literally take a convertible Ferrari, leave the keys in it, leave it running, and go in, do whatever you need to do, come back a couple hours later, and nobody would have touched your
That's
vehicle.
That's true. It's also one of the few countries in the world where the police also have Ferraris and similar cars.
And a Bentley. There's a Bentley police car as well, I think, in Old Town.
Where that's true. That's a sent a message that if you run fast, we can also run faster.
Well, at least, if you did get arrested, now I'm suggesting you could get arrested in style, I guess, here in Dubai. But so what's your final piece of advice for anybody who wants to kind of be successful in their career in the Middle East or even just as an economist, maybe?
Oh, I think... be very open-minded, I think, is particularly for people coming from outside the region. Be very open-minded. Integrate yourself as much as you can. Learn some Arabic. It's always good. Get networked. I think extremely important. For companies, I think, there are many programs right now, Saudization, Emiratization, Kuwaitization, you name it. We need to employ more and more of the youth in the countries of the GCC. So one word of advice, I think, to multinationals, to companies coming from outside, is have training programs, have internships. You need to do much more of that, so that you've got a well-diversified workforce where you're using the potential of the human capital of the region. I think that's important. I think for young people, don't just think of making the money. Think of how you're growing yourself, how you're growing your human capital. Try to get as much diverse experience as you can in life, as we said a bit earlier, and try to do it as early as you can. Be adventurous. Try different activities. But above all, I think you need to love what you do. Try to live your life intensely, whether it's your working life or outside. Every minute, every hour counts.
Right, and I like what you're saying, where you say we're focused on developing yourself, because one of the themes that I always like to go with is, if you want to earn more, you have to become more. And a lot of people think it's the other way around, that once you start earning more, you become more, but it doesn't really work that way.
No, it doesn't. And we've seen what happened in the great financial crisis. It turned out to be an illusion. And many fortunes that got made also got destroyed. And you'll see many people shifting out of finance and going into other activities. I talk a lot to graduates at some of the universities that we have here. And one of the words of advice is, think of manufacturing, think of industry, think of non-financial activities. Try to think there, because if you are interested in banking and finance, you better understand business and you better understand industry as well before you become a banker. A good banker needs to understand what he's financing and what he's banking.
Right. So so you're seeing now the trend for the students is to go more into industry and away from banking.
Well, the interesting thing is if you look at the technological forces at work, we were talking about robotics. There are so many new technologies that are now coming. We're now thinking of space as a new activity. In our part of the world, things like renewable energy, all of those new activities are also new technologies. I mean, that's very exciting, I think. you should think of orienting yourself towards that. Let's take right next door to us, Al Maktoum Airport is going to be an enormous logistics and transport hub. I've been proposing that we should develop a spaceport, that we should not just have the airport, we should also have a spaceport, because the next frontier is obviously going to be space. And think of the potential. You've got, say, Jabal Ali, so you've got a port, so you've got maritime transport, you've got land, you've got air transport. You already have that. Great. And it's integrated even better. But the next frontier is going to be space. So we're already talking about the commercialization of space, tourism in space, being able to do activities in space that we can't do on the Earth because you need weightlessness in some of the new technologies. So those are very attractive things to start getting into and challenging. Robotics is another one. So that means that you need to think more in terms of science and technology and growing the skill set allowing you to do that. Everybody, I think, even starting practically at nursery, should be able to do coding. We don't do that. So if you imagine building up your skill set, the wide variety of activities that you're going to be able to get into is unprecedented. I think that gives so much hope and is a reason for a great deal of optimism.
Well, Dr. Nasser, thank you so much again coming in and sharing your insights with us, and would have loved to do another hour. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Hopefully, we can have you on the show again sometime soon.
Thank you.
Thank you again. That's Dr. Nasser Saidi, founder and managing director of Nasser Saidi & Associates, which is a niche advisory and consulting company here in the GCC. Dr. Nasser was also the former chief economist for the DIFC and also holds a litany of senior and board level positions across the Gulf. Again, you can catch those podcasts on our website at dubaii1038.com. Go to /IonCareers and check out our podcasts. And that's it for this episode of Ion Careers. I'm Shane Phillips. Hoping the rest of your life is the best of your life.